to a pristine field of delicately crusted snow. A little backstory. Roy Smith, whom I introduced as a retired math teacher from a Chicago suburb, was on his way to a barn party near some acreage he owned in southern Wisconsin on a sunny September Saturday in 2013 when he spotted a dead but mostly intact raccoon by the side of the road. He stopped and tossed the roadkill into the back of his pickup truck, sudden inspiration growing in the back of his mind. He would place the critter's remains next to his fields to see if he could lure whatever had recently been leaving some odd tracks near the fence line and perhaps catch its image on his trail cam. The 6'2", science-minded 70-year-old had no idea that this simple act had in fact purchased him a front-row ticket to the outdoor theater of the absurd. In fact, he was about to be treated to an ongoing drama that would forever alter his views of reality and the nature of the universe. Smith continued on his way and enjoyed the social occasion. Afterward, he drove straight to the dirt two-track that led to his hay and alfalfa fields and dropped the raccoon in a patch of tall grass near a line of small trees and brush. He noted that the carcass made a dent in the otherwise undisturbed grass, and he left it lying in its nest until the next day, when he returned to mow hay at about 10 a.m. A grisly sight awaited him. "The raccoon had not been moved at all," said Smith, "but it appeared to have had its stomach opened. The raccoon's front wasn't torn in the way most hungry predators would go after it," he added, "but cut so cleanly it looked like it had been zipped open or parted with some sharp instrument. The intestines were lying intact in a clump outside the body," he said. "I was thinking, could a hawk do that?" Of course, he knew the answer to that question, having observed the way hawks and carnivorous mammals pull their meals apart bit by bit, scattering bits and bones as they jostle for their shares. Smith left the raccoon and its innards in place while he spent an hour and a half mowing hay, then returned to the remains. He intended to take some photos to document its odd condition, but was surprised to see that something with equal interest in the carcass had been there during his short absence. "I look in, and the raccoon has been moved 1 foot, and the intestines are gone, but nothing else was missing," he said. "The grass was still 3 feet high around it, not broken. Something had to reach into the grass, take the intestines out, and leave." Smith was now deeply perplexed, since the massive entrails had been scooped up whole. That implied something rather large had taken them. Moreover, the rest of the raccoon had not been touched. Why wouldn't its meat have been attractive to a hungry predator? The curious turn of events gnawed at him, and he resolved to continue the experiment. 2 days later, he found the roadside carcass of a badger and dumped it into the same grassy area. The raccoon was still there and mostly in one piece when he went to check it soon after, although some small animals had nibbled on it. Smith left the two carcasses to their fate and returned at 10 a.m. the next day. There had been some action. The dead badger had been tossed about 6 feet from its original grassy nest, and, as in the case of the raccoon, there were no signs of dragging or any other disturbance to the grass. The badger was intact. Nothing had cared to take a bite. The raccoon had also been moved to about 10 feet away and hadn't been touched since he'd last seen it either. That surprised Smith, knowing as he did that the area teemed with skunks, coyotes, turkey vultures, feral cats, and myriad other hungry animals looking to beef up their fat reserves for the coming winter. Paw prints from nowhere. It was about a week later, on October 4th, when Smith returned to his farm and checked the carcass area. This time he found several 4.5-inch canine prints in the field behind the fence line. The prints each featured 5 toes, all tipped with prominent claws. Most, though not all, canine prints will show only 4 digits. The 5th, known as the dew claw, usually rides higher up on the foot. A few prints also included the animal's hawk mark impressed several inches behind the toe pads, making those prints about 7 inches in total length. There were no visible front paw prints among the tracks. That meant, to Smith's great shock, that this creature had apparently walked on its hind legs as it headed into a nearby woods. The upright creature left further evidence of its visit in the form of a strong smell, Smith described as rancid and musty. It was so rank, he said, that a friend he'd brought with him went back to his vehicle for a shotgun, convinced something dangerous was still about. In the next few days, Smith threw in several more small roadkill carcasses, only to find similar results. Carcasses left intact, moved, or taken without the usual signs of small predators, and more large, weird animal tracks alongside those of the cautious coyotes that seemed to look but not touch. In mid-October, he installed a 3-megapixel Primos game camera about 8 feet from the carcass area and hoped the upright predator would be revealed. Instead, after he retrieved and reviewed the digital photos, he began to notice that although the camera appeared to function perfectly, no obvious triggering event ever appeared in those frames where the carcasses were moved or changed. In every case, however, the culprit had to have been smack in the camera's field of vision in order to get to the bait. Smith soon added a second and then a third camera of different makes and models, set in varying operational modes and all trained on the same bait spot. He also upped his carcass ante with a 60-pound deer his brother had found as roadkill in Illinois. He again dropped the bait into a nest in the grass next to what was left of the raccoon. When he returned after a week, on October 16th, the deer was simply gone. There were no drag marks, but there were more 5-toed canine prints outside the grassy area. The tracks were deeply imprinted into the dry soil, which meant they had to have been made by something fairly heavy. Of course, whatever had made the tracks carried the added weight of the deer as it made off with its prize. The carcass taker had not simply run across the field, either. It had to have found its way past the fence to enter the field behind it. Tufts of deer hair on the fence indicated that the carcass had been pulled through a wide opening in the barbed wire, dropped on the other side where it smashed down a small area of corn, and then picked up again and carried half a mile through the cornfield. The creature followed a serpentine path along the fence line and crossed a road to enter a neighbor's field. Smith and a companion tracked it about 20 feet into that field, but gave up the chase because they didn't want to trespass. These tracks also looked bipedal, with no visible prints from forepaws. And since the front and back paws of both bears and wolves are of different sizes, and shapes too, in the case of the bear, it is often possible to tell if a print has been double-stepped. Play Misty for me. Smith was sure he would have a picture of the deer napper on one of his 2 trail cams, but he was in for a surprise. The deer showed up intact on the camera at 10:17 the previous night. At 10:42, the camera was triggered again, but the area over the deer carcass somehow became completely obscured by a thick, rounded gray mist that shifted slightly but remained mostly in place for over 6 hours as the camera continued to take more than 100 photos of it. By the time the almost opaque substance disappeared, the carcass was gone, and the camera resumed taking perfectly clear photos of the area. The mist also showed up on a cell phone camera photo that Smith's friend took as the two men tracked the prints through that field. Smith consulted an Illinois animal tracking expert about the puzzling prints. The expert dismissed the photos Smith presented and all but called him a liar. She said these animal prints couldn't exist, said Smith. Smith knew they did exist and persisted in his search for answers. He asked a few of his neighbors what they thought of the prints and learned that this area about 30 miles north of the Wisconsin-Illinois border was famous for sightings of a huge wolf-like creature known locally as the Beast of Bray Road. The creature had menaced and frightened people in the area for several decades, Smith learned, although no humans had ever been actually attacked. Moreover, several of his neighbors told him they had glimpsed the beast, or at least some sort of mystery creature, themselves. By mere chance, he stopped for coffee at a small shop in Elkhorn soon after that. The shop was owned by the mother of a young man who had done some field work for Smith, and Smith casually asked her what she knew about the Beast of Bray Road. Her son had a book about it, she told Smith, and was a fan of the author, which, in the interest of full disclosure, happened to be me. My original breaking news story back on December 29, 1991, in the local publication The Week, Walworth County's newspaper, had set me off on what would become a career of investigating and reporting on these and other unknown creatures, and I'd been keeping tabs on Bray Road events and similar worldwide sightings ever since. Smith emailed me and asked if I could talk to him, and we met at an area restaurant. I had to admit I was intrigued with his description of the happenings in his field, and eager to see photos of those paw prints. Smith arrived, armed with meticulous field notes and a stack of photos to back up his claims, as was only appropriate for a former educator. He explained he was finally driven to contact me by the weight of his accumulated, unexplainable evidence. "If you would have shown me any of your books 2 months ago," he said, "I would have thrown them back at you. I'm a mathematician. Things like this don't happen in the real world." I was amazed myself as he shared that sequence of events. I'd never seen anything like this weird mist and its cloud-like formation and hints of various colors within the gray. It did not appear to be a camera defect, reflection of dust or insects or any other explanation I could think of. The mist areas were well-defined, and the other areas in the photos were crisp and clear. The substance also showed up on a different trail cam Smith triggered as he changed an SD card, even though he saw nothing out of the ordinary at that time, and it was a clear day. The mist was evidently invisible to the naked eye. Smith came to an unsettling conclusion about whatever was committing the predation. "This thing cloaks itself," he said. That was a bold remark, I thought, and one that could set off fresh rounds of social media group battles between those who believe Bigfoots, dogmen, and the like are natural animals, and those who think they are at least partly non-physical and may have unusual talents. But to Smith, there seemed to be no other explanation. Cloaked in suspicion, camouflage, and virtual invisibility. I've always reserved opinion on the cloaking issue, mostly because reports of it are fairly rare compared to non-cloaking reports, and they may vary quite a lot in description. But it's not as if animal camouflage is physically impossible. Some members of the animal kingdom disguise themselves almost automatically. Chameleons will change colors to blend into their background, for instance. A species of Indonesian cephalopod called the mimic octopus, or Thaumoctopus mimicus, not only changes skin colors and patterns, but can twist itself around to resemble other creatures, such as the sea snake. Neither of these types of cloaking have anything to do with otherworldly powers, of course, but perhaps with the right lighting, a larger creature equipped with chameleon-like skin or a layer of transparent light-refracting hair could fool the human eye into thinking it had caught a flash of something like a predator-type disguise. We humans are catching on to this valuable ability as well. Scientists are already demonstrating early models of devices that can bend light to produce virtual invisibility. In most of them, our eyes are tricked into thinking we are seeing through something when we're actually seeing around it by means of curved light. As far as Smith's field was concerned, however, these explainable types of disguises didn't seem to be what his cameras were showing. Smith's photos of obscuring mist looked less like body-changing camouflage and more like the way squids hide the ink they squirt around themselves. But Smith's field mist filled a defined columnal area, rather than blending the unknown creature's shape into its surroundings as a plume of ink will disperse into water. Its appearance also reminded me of descriptions of the cloud pillar in the Old Testament's book of Exodus that led Moses and the children safely through their wanderings. This hayfield, though, was definitely not any route to the Promised Land and wasn't even the sort of habitat where self-camouflaging chameleons or squids might hang out. What, then, was creating such odd phenomena? Cloaking mists, tracks that went nowhere, and peculiar carcass predation? That was the question I started with as I began to try to help Smith. But I soon discovered those columns of mist were turning up in other places as well. The Heartland Hairy Thing. A Heartland, Wisconsin woman, I'll call Susan, wrote me to report one of the most chilling sightings of an upright unknown canine that I've heard anywhere, given the creature's uncanny interest in her family home. What we know, based upon her sighting, and backed up by evidence that I found outside her home, is that a 6-foot-tall bipedal creature with a canine-like head and anatomy and tracks resembling those of a large wolf or dog had been snooping around on her family's yard since early summer. It seemed particularly interested in the window of her special needs child's bedroom. The encounter took place the night of Thursday, July 17, 2014, on her property inside the Heartland city limits. Susan and her husband are intelligent, credible people on the younger side of middle-aged and asked to remain anonymous to avoid any impact on their business and employment. As happens with most witnesses, Susan had absolutely nothing to gain by coming forward with her experience other than the relief of sharing with someone who wouldn't immediately doubt her sanity. It takes a certain amount of bravery to acknowledge that something so out of the ordinary had happened, and then to take steps to learn what it might be. Whatever the creature was, it had a lot of chutzpah to be frequenting such a densely populated neighborhood. Most unsettling, though, was my eventual conclusion that few things about this unknown creature could be shoehorned into some mundane explanation. Susan had found me by searching online and called me only 4 days after the incident, on July 21st. I was very pleased that the encounter was so recent, since time is often of the essence in field investigations. Rain, wind, animal activities, and seemingly harmless human habits, such as lawn care, can destroy fragile evidence like footprints, scat, or hair samples in the blink of a cryptid's glowing eye. We started the investigation, as I often do, with a long phone interview. Susan said she had arisen that night of the 17th at about 1:30 a.m. due to the insistent yapping of her small dog. She hadn't actually fallen asleep yet, she said, and was awake and alert. Thinking the pooch needed to relieve itself, she ushered it outdoors to the deck behind her home, expecting her pet to run out into the yard, as was its habit. Instead, it stopped barking and cowered behind her on the deck. She could see something tall and furry moving by the trees at the back of her yard, which was lit by her deck lamps as well as other house and street lights around the neighborhood. The mysterious form strode along a mulched area on the lot lines between her property and that of the neighbor behind them. It appeared to have emerged from a small thicket at the back of another neighbor's yard. "At first, I thought someone was playing a trick on me," she said, "or that it was a person wearing a thick gray jacket." Then she realized the figure definitely wasn't human, and it wasn't wearing a jacket. Susan was stunned to see that its body was entirely gray-furred, although the fur appeared thickest on the creature's muscular chest to give it that jacket-like impression. Its head was that of an animal, with short, pointed ears on top of the head and a short snout, like that of a boxer or other short-snouted canine, but definitely not flat, like a human's, she said. Its forelimbs hung at its sides and seemed muscular at the top, but they ended in longish paws with noticeable claws. They weren't long like a Bigfoot's, Susan noted, adding that its thighs were also muscular but thinned toward the lower limbs, and that it walked on its toe pads rather than flat-footed. The legs were canine, she said. Measurements of a tree branch that the creature just barely passed beneath showed the animal stood about 6 feet tall. As Susan gaped at the creature easily stalking its way across the back lot line of her yard, it suddenly swiveled its gray head to stare directly at her. There wasn't enough light on its face that she could see its eyes or even any reflected eye shine, she said, but she knew that it saw her and that it realized she was observing it. And then it kept on walking like it didn't care, said Susan. That was the moment she decided she'd had enough. She grabbed her dog and scrambled back inside her house. She did not sleep at all for the rest of that night, she added. The next morning, she called the local police and told an officer what she had seen. Although she expected a negative reaction, she was surprised when the officer told her he believed her and urged her to be cautious. She asked him if there had been other reports like hers, and he did not answer. That led me, of course, to think that there were probably other reports. In my experience, most people who contact local authorities after seeing an unidentifiable animal, especially one walking on its hind legs, do not receive such a supportive reaction. Usually, officers will crack jokes or assert straight up that the witness is mistaken or even lying. But the strangeness didn't end with that report to local authorities. On Sunday, July 20th, Susan's dog again began whining and crying whenever it went near the rear patio door, so that Susan had to begin taking her out to the front yard instead. She emailed me the next day. Our phone interview followed, and I drove to Heartland the very next day, Tuesday, July 22nd. After meeting her in person, I was even more impressed with Susan's forthright manner and with her determination to find out what that creature might have been. We began by touring her property, starting with the deck. We then examined the rear of her yard, where she had seen the creature, and found numerous deep impressions in the mulch-dirt mixture. There were two different types of tracks. Some were obviously those of a deer, while the others appeared roughly canine and measured about 4.5 to 5 inches in length. They were remarkably discernible, given the distortion normally caused by the helter-skelter quality of mulch and the fact that they'd been there for about 5 days. The prints appeared to be made by the hind feet of something taking bipedal strides in a path that led across the mulch to an adjacent small woods. The prints were about 1 inch deep on average, which implied that they'd been made by something much heavier than we were, since neither Susan nor I could make any sort of dent or impression in the thinly spread mulch even by stomping or jumping. The prints were also very evident in the mulch beds surrounding the foundation of her house, especially under several of the windows. One of the windows belonged to the bedroom of her special needs child. The child had been telling Susan that there was a monster peering into that bedroom window almost every night for the past month. But since it was always gone by the time Susan got to the room, she assumed the child was imagining things. She does not think that anymore, she added. We also found a couple of small piles of scat near the house and in the rear of the yard that did not seem substantial enough to have come from the 6-foot-tall creature. My guess, based on many years of disgusting experience, was that they were from a raccoon. It seemed evident to me that something unusual had visited Susan's house. While many would consider it unlikely that a 6-foot-tall, bipedal, wolf-like creature could roam freely in an urban neighborhood, the village of Heartland might be attractive to such a canine for several reasons. There are abundant deer, as shown by the deer tracks across the backyard, and much available water. Heartland is very close to Pewaukee Lake, with 8 other closely connected small lakes sprinkled to its east and north. Moreover, the Kettle Moraine State Forest, a source of many legendary and recent cryptid sightings, also lies just to its north. I asked Susan if she'd ever heard of any other unidentifiable creatures sighted in that area. She hadn't, she said. She added, I know what I saw. I know it was definitely not a bear, she said. The legs were wrong, and it was too different, but it had that thicker chest. It sounded to me rather like the Eau Claire area bear wolf discussed earlier, and its location fits within the area I've mapped out for that thicker-chested type. The main reason she was willing to tell me her story, she said, was that she believed other people should know, for their own safety and that of their pets, that this creature might be out there. Before I left her that day, however, Susan confided one other thing that made me wonder if her sighting might end up in the small percentage of reports I receive with a whiff of something truly out of the ordinary. The recent sighting wasn't her first experience with a weird canine on this property. The family had a previous incident 3 years earlier, Susan told me, when a huge, white, blue-eyed, wolf-like canine walked up to the patio door of the home and just stared at the hot tub inside that room for a few moments before casually walking away. Susan was inside at the time, close enough to the glass door to take a very good look at the animal. It walked on all fours, and she estimated it stood 3 feet high at the shoulder as it calmly watched her. She didn't believe it was the same animal she had just seen, but she did consider it a spooky incident. And there were more spooky things to come. Susan called the police again to ask whether there had been more sightings. The officer she spoke to this time said no, but that the department would be alerted. He later told her that some of the officers, particularly those on third shift duty, seemed to already know about an unknown animal having been seen in the area, although he gave Susan no details regarding their comments. She gave me the names of both officers with whom she had talked. I also checked the local newspaper's published police logs to see if readers had been notified of the unknown animal. As usually happens in these cases, there was no mention of it. The night of July 22nd, Susan put fresh batteries in her motion sensor trail cam and mounted it on the pergola of her deck, aimed at the backyard. In the morning, there were no photos taken, perhaps because the new batteries had gone completely dead. She replaced the batteries, put the trail cam back in place, and decided to leave it for a couple of weeks. Susan also found a strange mark on the siding of her house that looked like a paw print made with fine mud or silt. It measured a little over 4 inches, about the same size as the prints in her yard. It was located 4 feet above the ground, too high and too big for a raccoon or the family's little dog to have made it. None of the family members had hands that size, and there was only one print and no scratches. It may have been entirely unrelated to the creature, but it struck Susan as odd, since she had never seen any kind of paw print on her house before. She took photos of the new mulch prints and the mud print on the siding and emailed them to me. It was definitely time to return to Heartland. That happened on the evening of Friday the 25th, with the aim of measuring and photographing the new prints, examining the paw print on the siding, and looking for hairs on the bark of the few trees on the lawn. I asked Susan if she would allow a stakeout into the much later hours of the night when the thing seemed to be around. She and her husband agreed to this the next time there was a spike in activity. That didn't take too long. It has happened in other cases I've investigated. Even when outdoor sightings have died down, eyewitnesses will begin to experience events of a paranormal nature both outside and inside their house. Only 2 weeks later, on Sunday, August 10th, Susan wrote me and said that in the middle of the previous week, she had taken her dog out on the deck at 1:30 a.m. and again saw some kind of large figure standing under her neighbor's big maple tree. She elected not to investigate it by herself. She was also worried because her child had started telling her there was a ghost in her bedroom. After that event, things seemed to quiet down for a few weeks. On the night of Sunday, August 31st, Susan was out in the yard between 11:30 p.m. and midnight with her dog when she heard a loud cracking sound, like a tree branch breaking on a neighbor's yard. She and the pooch hustled back indoors, and Susan closed the patio door and curtains, only to hear what sounded like a person walking around on the patio. Her husband took a quick look around but found nothing. The trail camera had been in place, but the batteries had once again gone dead. She replaced them the next day. Trail cam anomalies. On Monday night, Susan's dog and child were up most of the night, both of them too restless and upset to sleep, for no apparent reason. Susan checked her trail cam first thing on the morning of Tuesday, September 2nd, and finally found three very odd photos on it. The first two, taken 3 seconds apart, each showed a bright light from a neighbor's patio on the left side of the photo, and a strange column of thick, translucent mist on the right side of the photo, which would have been just a few feet from the right side of the deck. Both photos showed a denser form in the center of the mist that, at least to Susan's and my eyes, looked vaguely animal and vaguely human at the same time. The third photo was triggered about 7 hours later. Susan hadn't reset the date and timestamps on her camera, so we couldn't be sure of the exact hour, but it was evidently still dark out. Most of the photo was obscured by a mass of translucent, globular purple objects that seemed to both absorb and reflect the flash from Susan's camera. The one thing that confirmed this was indeed Susan's backyard was that the neighbor's bright patio light showed through the purple stuff in exactly the same spot, but obscured to a mere twinkle. I've seen a lot of weird photos, but never anything like this one. It seemed positioned much closer to the camera than the other two photos had been, and while it appeared somewhat organic, it didn't look recognizable as part of an insect, bird, or any other known creature. The camera was still fastened to a support post of Susan's deck pergola. Examining photos like these can be very tricky, of course. The human imagination often connects the dots in ways they were never meant to go, especially when the dots are murky to begin with. These photos displayed two definite images of the anomaly, however, and it appeared that the mist moved a foot or so from one frame to the next. I'm not someone who normally sees images of cryptids in landscape photos, however, and I'm very familiar with the human trait called pareidolia, the brain's automatic tendency to seek identifiable images in areas of light and shadow or in random textures, such as seeing the shapes of animals in clouds. These photos, as part of a broader case study, seen in tandem with Susan's sighting and the footprints, seemed deserving of closer study. I had spent many hours searching the internet for similar photo phenomena and accompanying expert analyses. The best I could come up with for the misty columns was that they were lens flares caused by reflections from the neighbor's patio light, except that didn't account for the weird twisting of the denser form within each of the columns. I was at a total loss for the purple globules that reminded me of buboes from the plagues of the Dark Ages. One website that analyzes photos displaying anomalous images was kind enough to make some suggestions, but preferred I not quote them directly. They had three possible explanations regarding the misty columns: an insect reflection, someone's breath fogging the camera lens, or some type of sporadic ground mist that had somehow confined itself to that shape and maintained its density for two photos before completely disappearing. They had no suggestion as to what might have triggered the motion sensor in each case. They thought the purple globular things were probably caused by the edge of someone's finger just far enough over the edge of the lens so that it could record an image, but not at a proper distance for good resolution. However, a sample on their site in which this was probably the case showed round, flat objects rather than organic shapes with volume as in the globules in Susan's shot. Their alternate suggestion for this photo was that a few drops of liquid fell on the lens and created a close-up shot of multiple water drops. This still wouldn't have triggered the motion sensor, however. Explainable or not, the eerie photos still reminded me of the many trail cam shots from Roy Smith's field, where we found similar canine prints. In each case, part of the photo remained sharp and clear around the strange blurred area, and the cameras triggered and worked perfectly when it came to capturing photos of ordinary known animals. And in all these cases, there was no bright light anywhere near enough to have shown up as lens flares. As soon as I saw Susan's photos, I knew it was time for the nighttime stakeout. That evening's activity started with a canvas of the neighborhood by foot and by car to see just how much cover there was for a large predator. There were a surprising amount of wooded grounds in the neighborhood, enough to allow such a creature to make its rounds unobserved and then escape to a freeway corridor, U.S. Highway 16, and back into a more rural area. The deck offered a perfect view of the yard from the same spot where Susan had been when she spotted the creature. With video and still cameras, audio recorder, and flashlights ready, it was a warm end-of-summer evening with adequate ambient light and no precipitation, so conditions were perfect. Susan even provided a bowl of popcorn, and I tried to munch quietly as I wondered what I would actually do if a 6-foot-tall dog man did show up to saunter across the yard. The stakeout, alas, as usually happens whenever investigators are present, proved uneventful. The only creatures that showed up were one small, scrawny, and possibly sick raccoon in the neighbor's yard, and what appeared to be a smallish coyote sniffing around another neighbor's garbage. Neither animal would ever be mistaken for an upright 6-foot dog man. But Susan, her child, and the family dog would soon begin noticing odd things indoors again. Make it go away. In early January 2015, Susan said her child ran to get her and was shaking with fright, asking frantically for Susan to make it go away. The child pointed at a specific spot in the kitchen, which opens onto the back deck, and insisted there was a black figure standing there. Susan loudly told it to go away, and it did. A few nights later, Susan noticed her dog running between the kitchen and living room, as if chasing or playing with someone. Susan walked to the living room, which was darkened at the time, and was startled when the dog began to bark at the wall, acting as if someone or something was interacting. Around the same time, Susan would wake up to find her open bedroom door had been quietly closed. Toilets would begin running, and the child was awakened one night by a burst of bright light coming from her bedroom closet. Susan saw it too. She also captured a weird growling noise on video while recording a cute moment between her little dog and a toy dog. Her dog was silent in the video, but I could plainly hear the growling coming from some other source. She also began to hear unusual knocking on the walls and footsteps when no one was there. Susan began to say prayers, asking for blessing and protection over her windows and doors, and the phenomena dwindled again. But in early February 2015, she heard from her police contact that another woman who lived on her street and only a block away had reported large, unusual animal tracks that crossed her yard and circled her house. That sounded very familiar to Susan, and she has continued to keep a sharp eye out. Since then, incidents both indoors and out have quieted. Having a trail cam in place and extra patio lights have probably also been a help. She has found several more strange photos on the trail camera, but nothing so far that would help make a positive identification. It's a situation I continue to monitor. Encounter case summary. The Heartland Hairy Thing. Reported creature or creatures. 6-foot-tall, gray-furred, bipedal canine. Location, date. Residential area of Heartland, Wisconsin, beginning July 17, 2014, and continuing to present. Conditions. Night of initial sighting was warm, clear night with lighting provided by deck lamps, street lights, and neighbors' outdoor lights. from distance of about 100 feet. Associated phenomena. Trail cam photos of dense, defined column of mist with figure-like darker form in center, large and deep bipedal paw prints around yard and under window. Child reporting the face of a monster in the window. Poltergeist-like activities inside home. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature. A canine observed walking bipedally, showing strange curiosity in the home and child's bedroom. Witness or witnesses. A younger middle-aged woman saw a creature walking in the yard. A preteen child saw the creature's face in her bedroom window multiple times. Environmental factors. Although located in a residential area, the home was surrounded by pockets of dense plantings and tree canopy, and was not far from water areas and from a freeway edged by steep ditches, fields, and woods. Moon phase. July 17, 2014, time of initial sighting, waning 3/4 or less moon. Solar flares. Solar activity declined to nearly zero on the side of the sun facing the Earth in that week. Influence on Earth would have been minimal. The mists of time. Common origin? Researcher Jenny Randles believes most of these misty anomalies, from the green haze discussed earlier to the translucent columns seen near strange animal tracks and sightings, may share a common origin that has nothing to do with mundane meteorology, extraterrestrials, or ghostly hauntings. She calls them time storms, and says in a book by the same name, it may be one of the most fascinating phenomena in science today, yet it has attracted hardly any meaningful investigation. This is not a supernatural fantasy. It is completely real. She adds, I believe we can accept that they occur through energy fields that trigger rifts in space-time. As a consequence, they produce some extraordinary possibilities. Although their cause is presently unknown, she suggests several ideas. One is that they are caused by mini black holes formed by atmospheric disturbances. Another is that they may be a blend of floating cosmic leftovers from the massive amounts of electromagnetic fields created daily by human communications and industries. She cites examples of all kinds of human haze interactions, describing clouds in many other colors beside the green mists we've examined, including orange, blue, black, and even rainbow. And while the mists Randles describes aren't necessarily linked to strange creatures or even sightings hotspots, they behave much like the green haze Kevin saw in Racine County, Wisconsin, engulfing vehicles as if attracted to them and stopping the automobile's electronic systems. They also seem to sicken people caught inside them, often leaving them with apparent damage to their nervous system. Witnesses may report not simply minutes of missing time, as happened to Kevin, but hours, days, or even weeks lost to memory. Perhaps most puzzling are those cases in which witnesses find themselves transported various distances from where they first encountered the mist or fog. I discovered one story of a mist that transported the eyewitness someplace that was more likely to have been worlds rather than mere miles away. Former Western Michigan University professor of natural science Michael Swords recounted the incident, which was originally sent by a copper miner to the late UFO researcher Alan Hynek on Swords' blog, The Biggest Study. The location was in northern Canada, near Yellowknife, on Coppermine Mountain. The miner encountered the mist while exploring the bottom of a 50-foot-deep gully full of what looked like very old rocks, and little else except for a tubular mist that was distinct from the rest of the atmosphere. Rather recklessly, he decided to walk into it, and was amazed to find himself wading into a field of 3-foot-high grass. He was able to step out of the mist and then back in without problem, until he walked in a bit farther and saw a lakeside oasis, with a lake set diagonally into a hillside, and two robed, humanoid figures watching him as they floated several feet above the grass. At this point, he decided to exit, which he could manage only with great difficulty. Swords asked, "Did our fine fellow not only walk through a portal mist into Faerie, but even encounter two of its inhabitants?" He also mentioned several similar encounters described elsewhere on his blog. The floating humanoids bring Kristen Page's Canada incident to mind, as it seemed that at least one of the entities that carried him into the cornfield was either floating or much taller than the others. Were they, perhaps, carting him off to the nearest portal into that same strange world? Topanga Canyon Sheep Mist. Accounts of people who walk or drive into weird, cloudy formations and then experience various degrees of the Oz factor and even apparent teleportation can be found tucked randomly into a variety of books on paranormal topics, usually as odd asides in chapters devoted to things like UFO abductions or ghostly hauntings. The most bizarre mist account I've seen anywhere comes from California author Preston Dennett's UFOs Over Topanga Canyon, and describes a thing made of closely densely packed fog that was itself some kind of creature. Dennett attributed the story to a local Topanga newspaper, The Messenger. The eyewitness, a 40-plus Topanga resident and self-described UFO skeptic, said that it reminded her of a sheep, except that where its eyes should have been, there were only dark, entirely empty holes that she could look right through to see the landscape behind it. The woman said she had a good look at the creature in the Topanga Canyon area on two separate occasions, and she was adamant that the four-legged thing was not an actual sheep or any other kind of physical animal. She said that it seemed to glide along, much as any rolling fog or mist will do, as it crossed the road in front of her and went on its way down the mountain slope. Her best guess as to the thing's nature was that it was some type of spirit, and she mentioned the nearby Chumash burial grounds as having some possible relation to the creature. While there were no visible anomalous lights spotted anywhere near the creature during that sighting, Dennett's book documents an impressive array of UFOs and other anomalies in the Topanga Canyon area. Dennett said that the sightings he investigated in the early to mid-1990s included hundreds of reports from Topanga Canyon alone and dozens of others from neighboring Santa Monica and Malibu. These include virtually every type of report, including unexplained lights, metallic ships, landings, car chases, helicopter chases, missing time abductions, healing cases, animal mutilations, strange creatures, and possible government surveillance. Whether this eyeless sheep was related to any of the UFOs remains unknown, since the eyewitness didn't report any strange craft or lights at the time, but given the great number of UFO sightings in the community of about 8,000 people over such a short span of time, I think the odds are better than average that it may have been the case. The thing certainly didn't originate in any natural flock. The next report also involves a mountainous slope, a roadway, and something that was not what it first seemed. It's unique among all the reports I've received, ever. But since it incorporates an unknown luminous object and a cryptid, it's probably the perfect choice with which to end this section about unknown lights. Pennsylvania Glowstick Dogman. It's one thing for an upright, hairy biped to appear in a place associated with lights and UFOs. It's quite another for such a creature to emit mysterious light from its own body. And yet, this is exactly what Mike Moran, a resident of New York State, witnessed in 1994 as he and his wife were driving south through northern Pennsylvania on a road trip to visit his father. Because some time has passed since the incident, Mike isn't positive which highway he was on, but believes he was traveling on U.S. 81. He does clearly remember that he was driving up a hill, with forests on either side, at a speed of between 45 and 55 miles per hour, when a strange light caught his eye. He wrote, I looked up into the trees because I saw a light that appeared to be coming down the hill fast toward the road in a kind of bobbing motion. I thought maybe it was someone on a four-wheeler, but that didn't seem right since it looked like a dangerous time and place to be on one. I was worried about possibly crashing into the thing, and I couldn't imagine what it could be. My best guess was an ATV. At one point, I remember wondering if the locals were out having a torchlight procession in the forest. Some way that he was moving in the trees brought that to mind. I was giving the light a lot of attention while keeping an eye on the road. Moran was also worried due to the structure of the highway at that particular point. It looked as if the road had been cut into the hill, he wrote, because there was a 6 to 8 foot vertical face running along the side of the road, like a little cliff. I recall thinking that if the light was an ATV and it came down to the road, it would have a real problem with the vertical face. When the light actually did begin to come down the hill toward the road, I got excited because I was about to see what the heck it was, but I was also worried about possibly seeing an ATV crash. When it successfully negotiated the vertical face and got down on the road, I was astonished. The light reached the road about 25 yards or so in front of my car. I couldn't believe this thing had just come down the hill out of the trees right in front of me. The thing kept going across the road as I drove toward it. Well, it wasn't a four-wheeler. It was a powerfully built canine being running on two legs, about 7 or 8 feet tall, about 300 pounds, that appeared to have a glow to it. Its color was a bluish, whitish, light grayish. It gave the impression of a dog more than a wolf or other canine-type animal. I couldn't tell if it had fur, but if it did, it would have been short and all the same length. I don't recall a mane or a tail. It gave the impression of being male, but there were no overt clues. The creature bounded across the road in only 3 steps, said Moran, and continued on its way on the other side of the highway, disappearing in the forest of that side's downward slope. He asked his wife if the thing that just crossed the road had a dog's head, and she immediately replied that yes, it did. When I saw the dog's head, I didn't even know what to think, said Moran. It ran on 2 legs very naturally, as if it were meant to do so, with no awkwardness. It was looking in both directions as it crossed the road, and at one point it looked directly at my car coming toward it. Moran added later that he did not see any eye shine. Its eyes appeared black. It seemed to be very much on a mission, very purposeful. It did not look malevolent or benevolent. I just kept driving without changing speed or stopping to investigate. I thought about stopping, but that seemed foolish. It could not have been more than 1 or 2 minutes from the time I first saw the light up on the side of the hill to when it went out of view after crossing the road. However, it left a powerful impression. At the time, Anubis, Egyptian jackal-headed god of the underworld, came to mind, but didn't really seem to fit. Dogman is a good term. Moran said he was experiencing a mix of emotions as he sped on his way that night. I was excited, he said, but also a bit annoyed or resentful because I had no use for a dogman sighting. Who was I going to tell without appearing goofy at best? I think my ambivalence is the reason for not remembering more about the exact date and location. I started putting it out of my mind almost as soon as it happened. It's not that it was horrifying, but kind of pointless. For instance, we did not tell my father when we got to his house, and have never told him. Moran said that it was only after reading about others with similar experiences in American Monsters, A History of Monster Lore, Legends, and Sightings in America, that he felt he wanted to finally report his own. He added that he had never really thought much about unknown creatures, especially not glow-in-the-dark specimens. Before seeing him, I had no knowledge of or experience with or expectation of seeing dog men, he said. This also goes for the paranormal in general. I had heard of wolf men and the other usual paranormal stuff, of course, but I wasn't super interested in it. Not that I was against it in any way, though. Before seeing him as a dog man crossing the road, I experienced him for a while as a mysterious, intriguing light on the side of the hill, doing God knows what, that I was trying hard to make sense of. But I always thought of him as being solid and physically present. Moran was kind enough to try his hand at a sketch. He made a few side notes about the creature's fur, or possible lack of it, saying, I don't know if it was his fur, specifically, if he had any, that was luminous. From a distance, he looked pretty smooth, like a short-furred dog, such as a beagle. My question in this case of high strangeness is whether the blue light Moran first saw was some type of light anomaly that took dogman form only as it neared Moran, or whether it was primarily a canid figure with an unexplainable glow. It's possible, given our previous discussions on spook lights, ball lightning, and shapeshifters said to travel as balls of light, that what Moran first spotted was indeed a light form that coalesced into the solid, powerful dogman figure that then crossed the road and turned its head to look at him with its lightless eyes. Those dark eyes, which I'd think would have reflected at least a glint of Moran's headlights had this been a natural animal, reminded me of the dark, empty eye sockets of the misty sheep spotted on the slopes of the Topanga Canyon mentioned earlier. The actions of the two creatures are similar in both instances, as is the sloped terrain. And we also have previous examples of very thick, discrete mists forming in the same area where dogmen sightings and prints have been reported, similar to those we've discussed around Bray Road and Burlington, Wisconsin. For all we know, Moran may have been lucky enough to see this entity in two different phases of its form. That may sound wacky, but at least one theoretical backup for this possibility exists and will be examined later. Encounter case summary. Pennsylvania glow stick dog man. Reported creature or creatures. Large, glowing, wolf-like creature. Location, date. Mountainside Highway in northern Pennsylvania, 1994. Conditions. Nighttime. Light provided by vehicle headlights and the creature itself. Associated phenomena. Blue moving light. Unknown whether light as first seen was emitted from creature or something else. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature. Extremely large creature ran easily on hind legs, emitted a bluish-colored glow from entire body. Witness or witnesses. Mike and Mrs. Moran, first name held by request, husband and wife. Environmental factors. Mountainous area with great access to uninhabited wooded areas, located probably only 60 to 100 miles directly north of Harrisburg, and its 2015 report of an upright wolfman. Moon and solar flare phases unknown. 5. Out of thin air, creatures, UFOs, and portals. Chapter 19. The Multiple Modes of UFOs. The aerial phenomenon known today as a UFO is not necessarily exclusive to the modern age. Witnesses through the ages have reported seeing unknown flying craft emerging from clouds, fireballs, and other light phenomena in the heavens above us. Sometimes the UFOs themselves resemble luminous clouds, glowing orbs, or fiery forms. Over time, various populations have described them using imagery familiar to their own culture, such as the fireships of the Anishinaabe, mentioned earlier by Kevin, the Wisconsin sheriff's deputy. These ancient allusions to sky serpents and dragons gradually gave way to today's more mechanistic images of flying saucers, motherships, spacecraft, and other airborne enigmas that have become pop icons of our time. Wildly popular TV shows, such as History Channel's Ancient Aliens, have thoroughly explored this theme in all corners of the globe, with the field's top authors and investigators, and no end of subject matter in sight. For any who may have been living in lava tubes in Hawaii without access to TV or the internet for the last couple of decades in order to survive the next big solar flare, I'll summarize the ancient alien premise. When flying saucers began to appear in noticeable numbers around the middle of the 20th century, most people assumed they were extraterrestrial in nature, having arrived here from Mars